their work to do, and they would do it. One morning, the Oberfeldwebel decided that it was time to make a show of force. The entire unit, all 12 men, would accompany him and the Feldwebel on a march around the town. This would show any elements of the population who thought they might be giving up that they were still very much in control. As they made their way down the main street, they encountered Mace, who was walking Peter Woodhouse, no longer wearing his compromising collar, but being led on the end of a string with a makeshift noose. The dog became tense as the sound of marching approached. When the men drew level with him, he growled and began to bark. Mace struck him on the back with a rolled-up newspaper he was carrying, but this had no effect. The barking became hysterical. Mace looked as apologetic as he could, because he saw the Germans looking in his direction, and tugged at the string lead. Enraged, Peter Woodhouse slipped out of his collar. There was nothing Mace could do other than shout and run after him, but it was too late. Peter Woodhouse had reached the first of the Germans and had lunged at the boots of one of the men. The soldier kicked out at him, and Peter Woodhouse attacked again. It was Ubi who managed to get him under control. Surprised by the familiar smell of someone whom he had by now got to know, Peter Woodhouse calmed down and began to lick his friend's hand. The Oberfeldwebel shouted an order, and another of the men stepped forward, loosened his belt, and put it round Peter Woodhouse's neck.
"Dietrich!" shouted the Oberfeldwebel. "Take that dog round the corner and shoot him!"
Ubi frowned.
"He's just a dog," he muttered. "Can't we just..."
He was not allowed to finish. A small group of children had gathered, and the Oberfeldwebel gestured towards them. The locals might need to be taught a lesson from time to time, but shooting a dog in front of children was unnecessary. Ubi tried to dissuade the Oberfeldwebel, but his pleas had no effect.
"You've been given an order," came the response. "Carry it out, unless you want to face the consequences."
He stood for a few moments while Mace approached the Oberfeldwebel, begging him to excuse the dog.
"He meant no harm," he said. "He was overexcited, that's all."
The Oberfeldwebel signalled him away with a movement of his pistol.
"I will not have my men attacked by dogs. Consider yourself fortunate that you are not being placed under arrest yourself."
Mace knew that he must not be arrested. He knew far too much about what people in the area were doing to subvert the occupation to allow himself to be handed over to the Gestapo. He could not run the risk of compromising those whose identity he knew. He made a gesture of acceptance and moved off. Ubi began to lead Peter Woodhouse away. The men were told that they could break for a smoke, and they did so, sitting on the edge of the town fountain, lighting up and talking among themselves. Round the corner, in the small deserted alley that led off the main street, Ubi dragged Peter Woodhouse into the doorway of a now-closed tobacconist shop. The dog looked up at him and tried to lick his hand again. Ubi drew his pistol. He pulled the trigger, the shot reverberating against the walls of the houses in the narrow street. The bullet, aimed up in the air, sped harmlessly away. Peter Woodhouse cowered.
"Go!"
hissed Ubi, aiming a kick at the dog's rump.
"Run!"
At first, Peter Woodhouse simply continued to cower, but then a second kick, sharper than the first, made him move away. Ubi reached down to pick up a small stone at the edge of the road. He threw this at the dog as hard as he could, and it connected with his snout, making him yelp. Slowly, he began to move away, and then he broke into a faster run when Ubi sent another stone rattling down the street. A week later, they heard the sound of tanks, an unmistakable low growl coming from the south. There was some gunfire, but that did not last long, and the sound of the approaching tanks grew much louder. At 3 o'clock the following afternoon, a tank drew up at the bridge on the edge of the town, allowing a platoon of infantry to run down the road, dropping for cover from time to time as they tested the town's defences. A few shots were fired from the direction of the garrison, and these drew a fusillade of machine gun fire from two separate positions. A white flag cloth quickly appeared at one of the garrison windows, a towel it seemed, and this was waved energetically until a small line of men came out of the front door, their hands raised high in surrender. Almost immediately, the bell in the church began to toll, and people appeared in the streets. Dutch flags, hidden in anticipation of this day, were waved by excited children. Maze ran to the house where Mike and the navigator were hiding. He led them out into the street and urged them onto the main square. They blinked at the light. A woman threw her arms around Mike and kissed him. The navigator looked stunned and kept glancing up at the sky, as if expecting imminent attack. They watched as the Germans were given their instructions. Two Allied soldiers kept guard over them, occasionally prodding them with the butts of their rifles and kicking in their direction. An officer appeared and reprimanded the men. Then he spoke to the Oberfeldwebel in pidgin German. Maze came up and drew the officer aside, telling him that one of the garrison had collaborated with the resistance.
"Don't point him out to me," said the officer. "They'll kill him."
"I can give you his name," said Maze. "He deserves consideration." The officer nodded and wrote it down in his notebook. The Oberfeldwebel watched. Mike and the navigator did not know what to do. They spoke to the officer after he'd finished with the Oberfeldwebel. He said, "Don't do anything just now. We'll ask somebody to come and fetch you. It's all a bit mixed up at the moment, but the situation will become clearer in due course." He looked at the two airmen. "Is there anything I can do for you in the meantime? Need anything?" Mike nodded. "Could you send a message to our unit? They don't know we're alive." The officer nodded. "Write the details down. I'll try to get it sent from Eindhoven." One of May's friends appeared with Peter Woodhouse. The officer frowned. "What's this?" Mike smiled as he explained. "Our dog, our unit's mascot. He was shot down with us." The officer looked astonished. "He was in the plane?" "Yes," said Mike. He noticed that the Oberfeldwebel was staring at the dog. "Sir, you must take one of those men into protective custody." The officer looked irritated. "Why?" He indicated Maze. "This man's already spoken to me about him." "No, you must." Mike's voice had a note of urgency in it. The officer bristled. He was a captain, and a senior one at that, but he was not sure if he outranked this scruffy aviator. "I'm not sure you can tell me what to do." Mike fixed him with a cold stare. "I'm a serving officer. I'll take him as my prisoner." The officer's lip curled. "He's under my custody." Maze said, "I'll take him. He can be a prisoner of the resistance." The officer shook his head. "Don't be ridiculous. I don't know who you are." He hesitated. He had seen the Oberfeldwebel looking at Ubi, and he understood. Stepping forward, he pointed at Ubi. You there. You come with me." Maze quickly translated the command. His relief was palpable. Ubi stepped forward. He looked at Mike and smiled. Then he bent down and patted Peter Woodhouse gently on the back. "War's over," he murmured. The dog looked up at him. He was not sure. This was the man who had kicked him and thrown stones at him. The canine memory for that sort of thing is a long one, but something told him that all that was over. He had no word for it. But dogs can forgive, and he did. Chapter 17. Val asked Willie to peel the potatoes for their dinner that night. She had three large eggs given to her by Archie. She had told him that she did not feel entitled to them, as he had already given her two that week, but he insisted. She was going to make egg and potato pie, a dish that she knew both Willie and Annie particularly liked. The white sauce would have to be made without butter, but the richness of the eggs would make up for that. It had not been a good day. She had felt unwell early in the morning, which might have been morning sickness, she thought, or might have been something unconnected with the pregnancy. She had examined herself in the full-length mirror on the outside of her wardrobe, standing naked, sideways and then full-on, to see whether her body was changing shape. She thought it was, although how big would the baby be at this stage? Tiny, she decided. The size of a mouse, perhaps, tucked away in her stomach, somewhere vaguely down there. Precise female anatomy had never been properly explained at school, although the girls had been taken aside for instruction, and a visiting nurse had shown them a coloured diagram that none of them had properly understood. It was all tubes, she thought, and the baby was somewhere at the end of one of them, in the womb, wherever that was. She relaxed her muscles, and her belly sagged, more so than normal, she thought. So she was beginning to show, she told herself. People would be able to tell in a month, perhaps a little longer. She looked at her bust. She had never been proud of it because she thought it was too schoolgirlish, too small. She had seen the women painted on the fronts of the American planes at the base, some of them completely naked, others wearing very little, but they all had much larger busts. They held them out before them like those carvings seamen had on the prows of sailing ships. That's what men liked, it seemed, women with that sort of bust, not one like hers. And yet Mike had said that her body was just perfect, and she thought he had meant it. Now he would never see her like this. He would never see her carrying his child. He would never be able to put his hand on her stomach and feel the baby move within, which is what she had been told fathers-to-be liked to do, to feel the life they had helped to create. That would not happen. A few days earlier, she had been able to tell herself that she might see him again. She had felt that if she gave up all hope for him, she would somehow be bringing about his death. It was a superstitious belief. Talk of a man dying and you make it happen. People said something like that. She had heard them. So you didn't speculate as to somebody's chances, or at least not openly. But then she started to admit to herself that the possibility of his survival was, as they had told her, extremely slender. And what had made it worse was that the day before, when she had delivered eggs to the base, Sergeant Lazowski had asked her whether she wanted any of Mike's things. He had been as tactful as he could, saying that she could just look after them and give them back if he ever returned, but she knew that what was happening was a disposal of his effects. There was not much, she said. Some personal family photographs that would go back to his family in Muncie, along with his diary and an inscribed wristwatch that had his father's initials on it. But there were some other things, small things, that they would not normally send all the way back to the States, and she might like as mementos. She had said she would like them, and he had gone off to fetch a linen drawstring bag. He had given it to her without opening it to show her the contents, and it was not until she had returned to the house that she went to her room and opened the neck of the bag. There was a penknife. There was a set of navigator's calipers. There was a bow tie with red and blue stripes. There was the framed picture he had taken of her. She laid these things out on the bed, and then knelt at the side and let her head rest on the quilt. She reached for the bow tie, put it to her lips and kissed it. She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. She muttered, "Mike," and then, "My love, my love," and she repeated these words over and over again, her tears making the bed cover moist, their salt in her mouth. Now, as Willie peeled the potatoes for the egg and potato pie, she stood in the doorway and stared at his back. Should she have let Willie marry her? There would have been raised eyebrows, as many people would think that a woman should not take up with a man who was not quite all there. It was as if doing that would be to take advantage of him in some undefined way, sexual perhaps. But he would be loyal and kind, because both of these qualities were in his nature, and he would not make her unhappy. But then she told herself that what she had said to him, even if it was intended to be a simple explanation readily understood by somebody like him, was in fact the right thing to say. She believed that you married for love. You had to if you wanted it to work. She knew that there were women who married for money or for land, but were they truly married in the real sense of the word? Or were they just signing up for a business arrangement in which they gave what women gave their husbands in return for a roof over their heads and the necessities of life? It was possible that Willie would find somebody who would actually love him, and he needed to have that chance. There could well be a girl somewhere, a farmer's daughter maybe, who would be right for him. She would be plain, perhaps, but strong and resourceful. She would cook and darn clothes and keep the kitchen range well stoked up. And if she were a farmer's daughter, and there were no sons, then Willie could succeed to a farm and have his own place. That was possible, just possible. Willie finished peeling the potatoes. He turned to Val and said, "All done. Good potatoes, too. None of those black things in them. What do you call those black things, Val?"
"Eyes," she said. He smiled.
"That's right. Eyes. No eyes."
She crossed the room to stand beside him. The eggs were in a brown paper bag, and she reached into this to extract one of them.
"Look at this," she said. "I think I know which hen laid this one. She's a Rhode Island red, and she's bigger than the others."
He took the egg from her gingerly.
"Shall I put it in the pan?"
"Yes, and then we'll put the other ones in with it and fill it with water. They need to be hard-boiled for our pie."
He said,
"That's 6 minutes at least."
She nodded, and remembered that Willie had difficulty telling the time. She had tried to teach him when she realized this, but he had struggled to master the concept of minutes to the hour.
"Why," he asked, "if you counted up to 30, up to the figure 6, did you then start counting down?"
Her explanation, she feared, had been less than clear, and had merely added to his confusion. They put the egg pan on the stove and switched it on. It was an unsophisticated electric cooker, and it took a long time to get to temperature, but they were lucky. Plenty of people had nothing so advanced, and relied on ranges fueled by wood or coal. Willie was looking out of the window.
"That sergeant fellow," he said, "did you invite him?"
She frowned.
"No. Is he outside?"
"He's coming by here," said Willie. "Maybe he wants more eggs."
She moved to the window and looked out. Sergeant Lazowski was making his way down the front path, and he had a dog with him.
"He's got hold of another dog," said Willie. "He must have been missing Peter Woodhouse."
He turned to Val.
"Ain't that nice, Val, him getting another dog like that?"
She did not answer. Making her way to the front door, she took a deep breath, brushed her hair back from her forehead, and opened to the sergeant's knock.
Peter Woodhouse leapt up at her. It was a headlong dive, and she reeled under the onslaught. She almost fell over, but righted herself as the dog managed to lick her face, covering her with dog spittle. He was whimpering, the sort of excited whimpering that comes when a dog is overcome with emotion. Sergeant Lazowski stood there beaming.
"He remembers you," he said. "He hasn't forgotten."
"Is it really him?" she stuttered.
"Yes," said Sergeant Lazowski. "It's Peter Woodhouse. Look at the collar."
She struggled to get a sight of the collar. There was so much fur, so much wriggling dog muscle, that it was difficult to see the inscription. But it was there. And then, the full significance of this hit her. And she let out a scream.
"He's alive," said Sergeant Lazowski. "He'll be back in 2 or 3 days." She screamed again.
Willie was there now, and he was struggling to understand what was happening.
"Mike made it," said Sergeant Lazowski. "They sent the dog first because he didn't need a seat. Mike's waiting for a plane that's going out there soon. It'll bring him back."
Val flung her arms around the sergeant. He smelled of cooking, she thought, because he spent his days in the cookhouse. She kissed him on his neck, his chin, his cheek. He kissed her back and said,
"I shouldn't kiss another fella's girl, but what the heck?"
They told Val that she could see him the day after his return. The colonel, who had returned from London, saw Mike while Val waited outside the office. It was the day after VE Day, when the formal capitulation of Germany had occurred, and there were still signs of the previous day's celebrations. Somebody had tied a balloon to a fire bucket, and it was still there, half deflated.
"Well, it's over," said the colonel. "At least this bit of it." He paused. "And I think I know what you want to talk to me about."
Mike told him that they wanted to marry as soon as possible, and would like his permission. The colonel suppressed a sigh. These wartime marriages were troublesome. He had seen many of them come unstuck once the glamour faded, as it did. He gave his permission. And then he said that Peter Woodhouse, U.S. Air Force, dog, first class, could be officially reinstated as a mascot, if that was all right with the people who owned him,
but was not to fly without permission. Mike thanked the colonel and said that he felt one forced landing was enough for any dog. The colonel laughed.
"And your own future," he said. "I've heard that you might want to stay in. Is that correct?"
Mike nodded.
"I like flying, sir. It's what I want to do with my life."
When he had entered the Air Force, he had had only a vague interest in flying. Now that had all changed, and he had discovered it was the thing that he wanted to do above all else. He tried to explain it to the colonel.
"When I'm up there, sir, up above the clouds, I just feel, well, I feel that I'm in the right place, for me, that is. That's where I have to be."
The colonel smiled. There was no need for that feeling to be explained to him. He knew.
"Uncle Sam will still need pilots, and I think I can recommend you."
It was a strange moment for Mike. He had committed himself to a career, and he had chosen the woman he wanted to marry. It seemed to him as if the contours of his life, which had always been uncertain, were now set out as clearly and firmly as the lines on any map. Willie gave Val away, leading her down the aisle of the small church not far from the post office. She was visibly pregnant by the time of the wedding, but people pretended not to notice. Archie, uncomfortable in an unaccustomed suit, sang the hymns loudly and out of tune. Afterwards they went to the pub, where the landlord had laid out some of the tinned food that Mike had purloined from Sergeant Lazowski. He had told her that their future would still be uncertain. There was still work for the Air Force to do in Europe. They had been warned that this would not finish any time soon, and he hoped she would not mind if they did not make it to Muncie, Indiana, just yet. She said that she could accept that, as long as they went there sometime. The honeymoon was the last 3 days of the leave the colonel had granted Mike. They travelled in a borrowed car, using American fuel, to a small port in Cornwall, and climbed on the cliffs. They looked out in the direction of France, far away at that point, and were both for a moment silent with their thoughts. A breeze came up off the sea. She asked, inconsequentially, "What are you thinking of?" He turned to look at her. "I guess I was thinking of Peter Woodhouse." She smiled. She had no idea why she should have been thinking of Peter Woodhouse just then, but she was.
"So was I," she said.
He smiled. "Do you think it happens?"
"What happens?"
"Synchronicity." She looked puzzled. He was studying engineering, or had been, and that made him a scientist, she supposed. She knew nothing of science and the words that went with it. He explained. "It's what happens when people start doing things, or thinking things, at the same time." He paused. "They say that it happens a lot with married couples." He blushed. Neither of them was used to the fact of marriage. In the bed and breakfast in which they were staying, he had spoken the words, "my wife," with such hesitation and awkwardness as to attract a look of doubt to the owner's face. Mike had intercepted the glance to the hand, and to the rings, that had allayed suspicion, but the fact still seemed strange to him. How did married people behave? Was he convincing as a married man? Val liked the idea.
"I wouldn't have to ask you to do things," she said. "I'd just have to think them."
"And I'd do what you wanted," said Mike.
"Exactly."
They spent a great deal of time talking about the future. She seemed to have an insatiable appetite for information about Muncie and Indianapolis.
What colour would the roof be?
It would be red, he had no hesitation in answering that. And the kitchen? It would have everything, he promised, including a refrigerator large enough to walk into, well, almost, and cupboards with sliding doors. And she asked what they would do. He frowned.
Do? Yes, what would we do with our time?
He looked thoughtful.
Go for drives in the car?
Have you heard of drive-in movie theaters?
She had not, and he explained.
They're going to be big. Every town's getting one now. You park your car, you see, and you watch the movie from the car. 25 cents a person. And they sell hot dogs, popcorn, everything.
I'd like that.
Of course you would. We'd go every week, maybe twice a week.
America,
she sighed. It seemed an impossible dream. Safety, refrigerators, drive-in movies, if only the war would end, with them alive when it did. She closed her eyes and thought that if that happened, then she might stop doubting that God existed and say, yes, of course he does, because he would have brought them through this. It was almost a challenge to him. If he was there, prove it to me. Suddenly, an idea occurred to her. Do people believe in God in Muncie? She asked. He looked surprised. But of course they do, he answered. All of them? Pretty much. Then he said, and here? Don't people believe here? She thought for a moment. They say they do, but I'm not so sure that they do underneath. Maybe they hope that he's there.
It's easier if you believe, he said.
It makes you feel a bit... He trailed off. Braver, she thought. It makes you feel braver.
It makes you feel braver? He smiled. Boy, do we need that?
It was the closest he came to telling her how frightened he was. But she understood, and she steered the conversation away onto something less real. She asked about drive-in movie theatres and about where the sound came from. Did you leave your windows open? He smiled at her. You'll see, he said.
Part 2. He Hated the War. Chapter 18. A small square of roughly cut brown bread, stale and heavy, with a mug of lumpy soup scraped out of an urn. No meat in the soup, but a rancid smell that could have come from meat, an unfortunate horse, perhaps, or an ancient pig, a thin layer of grease, too, across the surface, that suggested the same origins. Ubi took it gratefully, warming his hands on the mug, which was made of tin and conducted heat well. It was early May, and the air was far from warm, even if the hedges were green once more, and there were wildflowers everywhere, and early blossom on the fruit trees. The man next to him spilled some of his soup down his chin and onto the jacket of his uniform. His hands were shaking, and it was hard for him to bring the mug to his lips. He looked sheepishly at Ubi, who smiled at him encouragingly. There were many who seemed to be fumbling or faltering in unexpected ways, tripping or stumbling, as if some internal gyroscope had been taken from them. One man, a Feldwebel like Ubi, seemed to have lost control of his bladder and sat dejectedly and self-consciously separate from the other men, staring up at the sky as if he were somewhere else, as if this were not him, this reeking, shameful person, a disgrace to the uniform he had so thoroughly ruined. Ubi took him an extra piece of bread that he found near the table where the rations had been handed out, and gave it to him in a gesture of support. The man took it and looked up at him briefly, but then looked away again without thanking him. It was the midday meal. There would be something more at 6 o'clock, they had been told, although it might not be warm. One of their Canadian captors, a sergeant with a loud voice, had explained through an interpreter that they could not expect much more because their own people had robbed the Netherlands of most of its food.
"So you see what this brings you," he announced. "What goes round comes round. Understand?"
He looked again at the puzzled faces and repeated his question.
"Understand?"
Because of the intervention of Mays and the captain who had taken their surrender, Ubi had been put into a different prisoner of war holding center from the rest of his unit. The captain had decided that if this were done, there would be little risk of retaliation from his former superiors or his colleagues. The chances of their encountering him among the thousands of prisoners of war caught up behind the rapidly advancing Allied lines would be next to non-existent. A note was left with the senior Canadian officer at the makeshift detention camp to the effect that Feldwebel Dietrich was alleged to have been helpful to the resistance and to a group of American airmen. This could be entered on his records, although nobody was sure what records there would be and who would hold them. At the camp itself, there was the barest noting down of name, age, and unit, with nothing said about anything else. On the third day of his captivity, when they were still bedding down in a field, all 200 of them, watched over by sentries posted along an ordinary stock fence, the Canadian officer in charge insisted on an examination of every prisoner.
In the raw spring air, they took off their tunics and their shirts and lined up in front of a couple of non-commissioned officers. Each man then held out his left arm to be checked for an SS number tattooed on the flesh. This was the mark of Cain that exposed those who had sought cover in the stolen uniforms of less guilty branches of the German forces. One man, exposed in this way, yelled out in protest, turning to the men behind him for support, but was greeted with indifference, even flickers of Schadenfreude. An orderly sprayed them for lice, the fine white powder a cloud of humiliation that hung about them for a few seconds before settling on skin and clothing. Ubi breathed it in and coughed and spat to rid himself of the chemical taste. He felt like an animal, prodded, probed, and treated for infestation before rejoining the herd of milling figures, clustering together like cattle. And everywhere he saw the raw hopelessness of defeat, only punctuated now and then by thoughts of how much worse it would have been had it been the Russians who had overrun them. The Russians were bent on revenge, shooting their captives out of hand or waiting for starvation or death by thirst to do their work for them. One of the men who had been on the Eastern Front told them of a unit of Georgian cannibals that had been let loose on German prisoners. They chose the youngest men, the boys of 15, even younger, who had been drafted in as the ranks of their elders were steadily diminished. "This happened," he said. "I saw it. They ate the boys." Ubi did not believe him. Men went mad in war, he thought, but not that mad. Such stories had been put about by the authorities to persuade people to fight when they had lost all enthusiasm for the cause. Ubi had never wanted to fight in the first place. His elder brother had been a communist and had told him that this war was nothing to do with the people of Germany, but was fratricidal lunacy inspired by a demented Austrian. His brother had expressed these views once too often and in the wrong company and disappeared without a trace one morning. That left Ubi with a mother and a sister, his father having died a few months after the war began. His mother and sister were in Berlin, and when news filtered through that the city had fallen to the Russians, he sat with his head in his hands, trying as hard as he could not to think about what would happen to them. It was unbearable, and he eventually told himself that they had both been killed in their sleep by a direct hit by an American bomb on their flat in Wedding. An American bomb would have been clean and merciful, and they would not have suffered, unlike those who found themselves in the path of Ivan. They were marched from one place to another, and eventually he found himself being called out at early morning muster and taken to a tent in which a Canadian major, flanked by an interpreter, quizzed him about his service record. There was not much to say, of course. He had had a quiet war, and had not so much as fired a shot in anger. He did not bother to tell his interrogator this, as it sounded such an unlikely story, and anyway would already have been used by those with most to hide. But that was not what the Canadian wanted to find out.
"We've had information,"
the major said, referring to a typewritten sheet before him, "that you were of assistance to two American airmen. Can you tell me a bit more about that?" He hesitated. He did not want to stand out from the crowd in any way. He wanted to be anonymous, just to be one of the hundreds of thousands of defeated soldiers who could not be individually punished for what had happened. He wanted to go home. He wanted to take off this uniform and escape from under the rank cloud that the army carried with it. In good times, a miasma of cruelty and noise and raucous singing, and now, in defeat, a dark air of gloom and brokenness. He wanted to sit with a girl in a cafe and drink coffee and feel the sunlight. He wanted to lie in a bath of soapy water. He wanted to clean and bind the recalcitrant ulcer that had developed on his right foot. He wanted not to smell. Would that ever again be possible? The world was in ruins. There would be no medicines for the dregs of this disgraced army. Coffee would be a distant memory, and what would girls want to do with the men whom they would blame for bringing this all about?
"Well, tell me," prompted the major, "what assistance did you provide?"
He saw that the major had cut himself while shaving and had applied a styptic pencil to the nick.
"I took food," he said.
The major stared at him.
"You didn't report them?"
He shook his head. He was tired. What was the point of going over the things that had happened in war? The dead stayed dead. The living preferred to forget. Did anything else really matter?
So you didn't report them, and you took them food. Why did you do this?
He shrugged.
The war was almost over, he said, and I didn't see any point.
He felt the Major's eyes on him. He looked away. He wanted this interview to come to an end.
The Major turned to the interpreter and said to him in English, "Is this man telling the truth?" The interpreter answered, "Yes, I think so. I can't be sure, sir, but liars talk in a different way. It's just something they do. This man isn't doing that."
The Major laughed.
"I wish I had your certainty. Mind reader, are you?"
"It's all there on that piece of paper," pointed out the interpreter. "He seems to be confirming it." The Major turned back to Ubi.
"We are sending home a number of prisoners," he said. "They are either very sick or very deserving. Mostly sick, although heaven knows what they can do for them back in Germany. A smaller number of men who have done something to help us, men like you. There are very few of those, I might add."
Ubi listened.
"You live in Berlin?"
"Yes."
"Would you like to go back there? The Soviets..." "But you are there too, I hear."
The Major nodded.
"The Americans, yes, the British and the French too. You can go if you wish."
He collected his few possessions, a kit bag, a spare shirt that he had tried to launder in cold water.
"Don't tell the other men you're leaving," the Major had warned him. "Say that you're being transferred to another prisoner of war camp. They might not take it too well."
When he went back to the Major's tent, he was told to take off his clothes and change into a new set of clothing they'd provided for him. The trousers were too large, but he was given an old tie to serve as a belt. They were at least clean, as was the shirt they gave him. There were even fresh underclothes, fastened with drawstrings, because elastic was hard to come by. His old clothing was picked up by a Canadian corporal, his face distorted with unconcealed distaste, and thrown on the ground outside.
"Burn all that," snapped the Major. "Don't leave it there, for God's sake."
The corporal went outside and gestured to a soldier to fetch a can of petrol. A few drops were sprinkled on the clothing and a match applied. Ubi was surprised at the size of the flames that enveloped his abandoned clothing, and the smoke, too. It was his past that was in flames, he thought. And he was grateful. He was cleansed. He had fresh clothing and was being taken back to Germany, taken home, to find out whether his mother and sister were still alive.
"You're a fortunate man," said the Major.
Ubi knew he was right. He wanted to thank the officer for what he had done, but he could not get the words out. Words, it seemed, had deserted him, as if his brain sensed that there was no point in trying to express the immensity of what had happened. Only two reactions to war seemed possible, a silence, as of horror, or a wail of anguish.
"You're fortunate because you're no longer in uniform," the Major went on. "These men," he gestured to the corporal and a guard standing at the entrance to the tent, "these men are still in uniform."
Now Ubi found his voice.
"You are very kind, sir." The Major sighed. "Doing my job, that's all."
He gave Ubi a piece of paper impressed with an official stamp.
"You are no longer a prisoner of war," he said. "You're demobilized, as of now. You are a civilian again."
They took him away with two other men. One had a bandaged head and looked dazed and unsure what was happening. The other seemed to be uninjured, but muttered incessantly under his breath in a heavy, unfamiliar dialect. They were driven to another army post, where they waited several hours before being loaded, with other men, into an army truck just as night was descending. The back of the truck was closed, and they saw nothing. One of the men started to sing one of the songs they had been taught, the Westerwaldlied, but this was greeted with scowls, and he stopped halfway through a line, awkward and embarrassed. They were transferred onto a train late at night, into an open wagon into which a few blankets had been tossed. They were not told where the train was going, other than Germany. They would have to make their way home from wherever it was that it stopped. After what seemed like an interminable wait, the engine started its journey. He tried to settle, lying down on one of the blankets, but the train jolted and squeaked, and sleep eluded him. Lying awake, he looked sideways through a gap in the slats that made up the side of the wagon, watching such lights as the battered towns possessed. There was an acrid smell. The train had been used for transporting lignite, and his new clothes were soon discolored with the dust of the cheap coal. He did not care. He was returning to Germany, and whatever had happened to it, it was still Germany. It was still his country. Chapter 19. With his release document in his hand, Ubi considered himself lucky. Others lingered far longer than he as prisoners or forced labourers, and many succumbed, particularly those who fell into the hands of the Russians. Yet he had a feeling of being cast adrift, at the beginning of a journey that would be long, complicated, and beset with bureaucratic obstacles. The original release paper, so potent in getting him on that train back to Germany, would have a great deal of work to do, and he feared it would soon lose its power. There were just too many displaced persons. There were just too many ration books and travel passes to be issued for much time to be spent on the claims of one young man who had been released early and simply wanted to get back to a home that probably no longer existed. A whole country had been uprooted and turned upside down. Everybody was looking for somebody, and the ether was full of echoing plaintive cries. Ich suche meine Frau. Ich suche meinen Sohn. I'm looking for my wife. I'm looking for my son. Scraps of paper were pinned on notice boards, half obscuring one another, like the overabundant leaves of trees in full foliage, each a record of a desperate attempt to find out what had happened to sons, to brothers, to husbands. Do you know anybody who was at Stalingrad? Did anybody ever mention a Sergeant Kurt Müller from Hamburg who was posted there? Prisoners of war were fed, but those, like Ubi, who were demobilized, had to find work if they were to eat. He had no idea whether his mother and sister were still alive. He had not heard from them, and he had found out that the street on which they lived in Berlin had been reduced to rubble. Stories of the atrocities suffered at the hands of the Russians had filtered through, whispered accounts of rape on an unremittingly brutal scale. They said that the bodies of those who were killed had simply disappeared under the broken buildings and would never be recovered. The rats grew fat on this hidden bounty. Their tunnels reached places where the efforts of those clearing the ruins would never penetrate. People said that it was a place of silence, like a city of the dead, shocked by the fate it had brought upon itself. The first train journey had ended at a station in a small city that had got off fairly lightly in the bombing raids. Almost three-quarters of it was intact, and there was food, too, as it was a market town for the surrounding countryside. Although there was no coal, the woods nearby provided wood for fuel, and people brought this into town each afternoon on handcarts, loaded with bark and hand-sawn timber. The population was less dispersed than in places where the physical destruction had been worse. Yet, even so, there were few men, and certainly not enough men of Ubi's age to do the work that needed to be done. He had been intending to join the streams of people he had seen heading to a nearby larger city, but on his first morning he was approached by a woman at the railway station. She asked him whether he could help her. She owned an inn, she said. Her husband had been on the Eastern Front, and there was no word of him. I don't think he will be back, she said. I like to tell myself otherwise, but I am a realist. He lowered his eyes. Was she blaming him in some way for what had happened? Her tone had been almost accusing, and he thought she might imagine him to be a party member, or an SS man, or something that he had not been. "In what way do you think I can help?" he asked. "I need somebody to help me at the inn," she said. "I need somebody to do the man's work, to fix things." She mentioned that the person who helped her would get a warm room. It was above the kitchen, and his keep. "I have food," she said. "My inn is being used by British officers who are billeted there. Not fighting people, administrators. They're the new government, you see. I prepare their rations." She looked at him meaningfully. "I prepare their rations," she repeated. Hunger gnawed at his stomach. He had not eaten for 18 hours, and from somewhere in the station there came the smell of soup. He was dirty. "I even have hot water," said the woman. "Not much, but enough." He met her gaze. "I want to get back to Berlin," he said. She looked at him as if he had said something beyond comprehension. "Berlin is full of Russians," she said, "and it's surrounded. I'd like to go eventually, but not now."
"Maybe not now," she smiled.
"So you'll work for me?" He nodded. He was tired. They walked back to the inn, which was not far from the station. A British military car was parked outside it, a Union Jack pennant limp in the lifeless air. "That's the English colonel's car," said the woman. "He has an office next to his room. He prefers to work there." He nodded. "Do they pay you?"
"Not what I would like, but something. It means I can keep the inn open. Most of the others have closed."
She showed him to his room. Her name, she told him, was Ilse Martin. Her father had been a Lutheran pastor, she said, and he had died 4 years before the war began.
"I'm glad he died then," she said. "He was spared the worst of the monster who got us into this."
"This war?" She looked at him cautiously. She had spoken freely, but now ancient habit reasserted itself. There were still fanatics who had not changed their views, and one had to be circumspect in what one said. He put her mind at rest.
"It's a pity they didn't hang him," he muttered. "They got the others, or a lot of them, but he cheated them."
She looked relieved.
"Well, that settles that," she said.
"If you make a fire under the boiler, you can have some hot water. I have a razor you can use, if you like." "It was my husband's." He mumbled something. What was there to say beyond the trite expressions of sympathy? As she had promised, his room was warm, the heat coming from the flue of the kitchen range directly below. This was exposed as it passed up through his room, and there was warmth, too, that came up through the floorboards, along with cooking smells. He later learned that there was coal. It was not meant for civilians, but the British officers were entitled to it, and they passed it on to Ilse for kitchen use. He took off his socks and felt the warmth underfoot. It took him back to Holland, where they had enjoyed an ample supply of wood for heating their barracks. Defeat had been cold. It had been hunger and cold.
"You may have a bath," said Ilse. "I have run the water for you. And there is soap."
He had not seen soap for weeks, and he handled it now as if it were something precious. In the bath he noticed that he was changing colour as the grime came off. It was as if he were shedding a skin. She entered the room with a towel, unconcerned at his nakedness. Nobody seemed to worry about such things any longer. Modesty was unimportant when survival was at stake. The towel was clean and smelled of something he could not quite place. And then he remembered. It was lavender. It was one of the familiar smells that had simply gone from his memory, replaced by the overpowering smells of war, smoke, burning rubber, the stink of putrefaction. There was even a smell for fear, a sharp, uneasy tang that was something to do with the sweat of frightened men. And now the smell of lavender came back to him, and as he pressed the towel to his face, he felt the urge to weep. There was so much to bring tears. The loss of those years of his youth, when he should have been happy, his recruitment into a cause of rampage and killing, the pain of others, the humiliation of defeat. He was nothing. The conquerors were here, among them, and he and so many like him counted for nothing. He went downstairs, where she gave him a bowl of soup. He sat at the kitchen table and tried to control his hunger. It would not do to sink this in a single draught, which is what he wanted to do. He did not want her to think he was that desperate. But he was, and the soup took seconds to disappear. She was watching, half amused, half pitying. "Let your stomach get used to food," she said. "They say that you can do damage if you eat too much too quickly." He nodded.
"I have been so hungry."
She smiled at him and poured a small second helping of soup into the bowl.
They expect us to survive on less than half of what they get, she said. I've seen it in print, in black and white. Our ration is meant to be 1,000 calories a day. We don't even get that. He stared into the soup bowl. Now it was all charity. Every scrap came at the will of those put in authority over them. And yet, he thought, this is our payback. This is what we started, if it was indeed true that we started it. He could not remember. There were vague claims. Had Poland provoked Germany? Had it been necessary to attack the Russians because of what they were doing to Germans who had the misfortune to live in the East? She was saying something to him about work, and he stopped thinking of issues of retribution. He apologized. I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. She explained that if he felt strong enough, there was wood to be chopped. She had bought a load of felled oak from a man she knew, but the pieces were too large to fit into the stove. And then there was a window that needed repairing. She had managed to get her hands on a piece of glass that should fit. It was probably stolen from somebody else, but if you started asking questions nowadays, you would never get anything done. Everything was stolen. And had he heard, the Russians had removed everything, even things that were bolted down, and sent it back to Russia. Whole factories, cranes, even small buildings that could be dismantled and shipped off. And people, too, of course. They were easy to transport. You simply loaded them onto the wagons of a train and then unloaded those who were still alive at the other end. Siberia or somewhere. Mind you, she said. He waited. Mind you what? Mind you, the colonel has shown me photographs that you wouldn't believe. Our people doing the same thing, packing people off to camps in the East. They died there, you know. She paused. He had photographs. They're making people, civilians, look at the photographs. Then they say, see this? See what you people did? He looked away. He would never have allowed anything like that. If there was a stain, then it was not on his hands. He started work after the meal. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, some of the officers who were billeted at the hotel returned from work. One of them looked at him with distaste and threw an inquiring look at Ilse. She shook her head. He was never in the army or anything, she said in English. She searched for the English word. Was there one? Esthma. She pointed at Ubi's chest. He did not understand, but the officer merely raised an eyebrow and went off to his room. Ilse turned to Ubi and told him what she had said. It's simpler that they don't know, she said. Especially that one. He likes young men, and it's best for you if he thinks you're, She tapped her chest. Understand? He tried to work out Ilse's age. Ubi was just 23, and he thought that she must be somewhere in her 30s. But 2 days after he arrived, she told him that she was coming up to her 28th birthday. She had married when she was 20, and had experienced barely 5 years of marriage before her husband had been conscripted into the army. She had managed to run the inn by herself, with the help of the staff who had been there since before they bought it, but then those people had retired, or moved for various reasons connected with the war, and she had been obliged to work longer and longer hours. At length it had been only her and 2 part-time chambermaids, which was why Ubi's arrival was so welcome. It did not take him long to settle in. The regular meals, the security of being host to the occupying forces, and the warmth and comfort of his room made him happy to stay where he was and not think about going on to Berlin. Winter was approaching, and people said that it would be severe. They said that rations would be reduced and that the slow march of starvation would devour whole swathes of Germany. It was no time to be doing anything adventurous. Far better to put up with the tedium of the woodcutting and the other mundane tasks he was expected to perform. It would be madness to go to Berlin at this point, Ilse said. The Russians could seize him on any grounds, or no grounds at all, and spirit him off to a factory or a mine in the Soviet Union. That had happened to hundreds of thousands of Germans, they said. Men who were now working in Soviet coal mines or on building sites, repairing the wrecked towns and cities. They would need more, as these men, undernourished and badly housed, died in droves. If you go to Berlin, she said,
then that will be you.
He realized that there would be work to do on the inn itself. Little maintenance had been done for years, the neglect going back to a time well before the war. There was a barn at the back full of old agricultural implements, and behind it, half covered by a frayed tarpaulin, some sort of round wooden structure that intrigued him. It was like a vast towering vat, a straight-sided wine barrel, perhaps, the height of at least three men, and of vast capacity. There was lettering on the side of it, but it was difficult, with the tarpaulin and the effect of weathering, to make out what this said. On the second day, he asked her, "That thing out there, that big barrel." They were standing in the kitchen, where he was drying plates before stacking them on the shelves. She smiled. "Big barrel? I suppose you could call it that." He waited for the explanation. She had moved over to the window and was looking out towards the barn. "It's a motordrome," she said. "It's a fairground thing. You ride your motorcycle round and round, and then you go up the wall and you carry on going round and round on that. You defy gravity. Fairground stuff." The shape. The writing, of course. "I know what a motorhome is," he said. "I've seen one before." "Well, that's what it is." He shook his head in disbelief. "You have a motorhome? It's pretty decrepit. It hasn't been used for years." He looked out of the window towards the barn. "Amazing. A motorhome. You know, when I was a boy, there were fairground people who came to Berlin. They must have been from somewhere deep in the south, because they spoke with a very broad Bavarian accent. You'd think they were singing half the time. They had a motorhome. I used to spend my pocket money on tickets to watch them. I loved it." She looked at him indulgently. "I suppose that when you're a boy, something like that is very exciting." "It was. It was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen." "I can imagine that," she said. "Noise, danger, speed. The things that boys like." And men, she thought. Hence this war. "I thought then," Ubi continued, "when I was a boy, that is, that I'd give anything, anything, to have a motordrome. I thought it would be the finest thing in the world to own a motordrome." Ilse laughed. "I'll sell you mine. Not that you or anybody else would want to buy it." Then she said, "You know what the English officers call it? It's called a wall of death over there, they told me. One of them was interested in it, the fat one with the moustache. He said he'd seen one in England, and that's what they called it." Ubi asked where it came from. "It belonged to my husband's uncle. He had no children, and he left it to him. My husband said he'd get it going again one day. The uncle always said there was good money in it." "He'd ride it himself?" She came back from the window and looked at him in a way that conveyed that she did not wish to talk about her husband. The knowledge that he had somewhere to stay, and the sense of security this brought, meant that the fractured, fitful sleep patterns that had been with him since his conscription were fading, and his nights becoming restful once again. He began to look forward to the moment when he finished the washing up after the evening meal, a task that Ilse had been eager to offload, and he could go up to his room, throw off his clothes, and sink into the haven of laundered sheets and a down mattress. It was unfathomable luxury for him after army beds, and then no bed at all. The dreams that came to him were vague and confused. He was in Holland, then he was somewhere else altogether, in a landscape he did not recognize. He was back at school, writing in an exercise book, dimly aware that he was being tested in some way. He was in the company of his brother, who had gone missing, who in his dream embraced him and told him that everything was all right, even though he was dead. In a vivid dream that recurred from time to time, he was in the presence of someone powerful. They were walking somewhere, and the other person was singing some little song under his breath, chopping at wildflowers with a walking stick. And he knew his name. That was the astonishing thing. He called him Ubi, and asked him if he had anything he wanted to say to him. Was this the Führer himself? Surely not, because he knew Ubi's name, and he looked different, although he was wearing something that looked like a uniform. He told Ilse about these dreams one day, and she said that it was very common to dream about their vanished leaders. "So many people have told me this happens to them," she said. "It's because they penetrated our lives so deeply. You dream of things like that, you know?" "And you?" he asked.
Do you dream about them, too?
She shook her head.
Not that I know of. But then they say, don't they, that everyone has